Hey everyone, this is Nick. Thanks for joining us for the Circuit Riders Podcast. To know us, we are a YWAM missions community here in Huntington Beach, California, with a passion to save the lost, revive the saved, and train them all. This podcast is from Monday Nights, our local community gathering. If you want to be a part of it and you live in the Southern California area, you are invited. Or if you don't live here but you want to join us online at crmovement.com/gatherings. Hope you enjoy the message.
Okay, love you guys. Thanks, guys. So good to be with you tonight. Thank you, Nicholas, for that introduction. Man, what an epic, epic worship time. We could just keep going all night long. And the hunger in this room is just so contagious. Incredible. This school has been incredible. I only had today with you guys, but you're pretty incredible. Pretty amazing. And I've heard nothing but great stuff about the whole 8 days. And then CR staff, so good to see you guys. It's family. Always good to see you guys. Love you so much. Would do anything for you guys. I'm your number one fan. I promise you that. I am Circuit Riders' number one fan, president of the fan club. And then all the crew that rolls in from Orange County, what an incredible opportunity to come to a Monday night and worship so wildly. This is just amazing. Like, that you have access to this every Monday night is incredible. There are not too many, there's just quite unique in the nation right now. So I just am so encouraged that people are rolling in from local churches that live in the surrounding area. And man, I bet you can't wait till August when it starts up again and have to move to a bigger room because this thing is just too packed out. It's already feeling that way, isn't it? So I wanna jump in tonight. And I want to share with you guys a little bit of what we just experienced in Norway together for the Send Norway. And then I'm going to kind of jump into scriptures for kind of a commissioning word like Nick said. I was sitting next to Zach and I was like, what if I just like bombed tonight? What if I was just like gave the most discouraging commissioning message you've ever heard in your life to see if you could overcome it and be commissioned? And I decided not to. I'm going to at least try. We'll see. Maybe it will be. I don't know. We'll see where it goes. I'll let you be the judge at the end. But we just got back from the Send Norway a couple weeks ago. And, of course, we had Kansas City in May and then Norway in June, end of June. And really the lead up to Norway was quite remarkable. For Norway, it was quite historic and for the Scandinavian region. And honestly, I look back on it and I would feel that it was every bit as impactful for Norway as the Send Brazil was for Brazil. And the Send Brazil just erupted. It was in three stadiums. It was caught national attention. And really, Norway was about the same in terms of its impact. And for about the 2 years leading up to Norway, we were heavily criticized in the media on a regular basis. Sometimes it was every day. Sometimes it was every week. And the Send was just absolutely massively criticized in the media. Rarely did we get much positive press. And the criticism was a number of different things, but majority of it kind of landed, and what they really began to go after was that the Send was promoting a dangerous gospel and promoting a radical lifestyle that was going to be dangerous in the end. And they would translate these articles for me. They'd translate them for me into English and then send them to me. And I remember reading a couple of them, and they quoted a number of us in there and these things we said, and then said added all these things. And I read the article and I was like, man, I believe everything in there. Like, send it out more. Send it out tomorrow. Like, reprint it. Like, we if it's not dangerous, it's not the gospel. And if it's not radical, it's not the gospel. There isn't a safe gospel in the scripture. You can't find in the Bible a gospel that is comfortable, safe, and accommodating. The gospel at its very nature is transformational, dangerous, and risk-taking. And so it was, you know, this was massive criticism coming against us, and it would spread across the media. We had every single denomination in the nation was behind the Send Norway, every denomination, every stream, including the Catholics. And the only ones that weren't were the few kind of movements that don't believe the Bible anymore, and we never expected them to join us anyway. But every Bible-believing denomination was 100% with us and behind us. But all of this press was this antagonism, and then it would say outright in the articles, we challenge you as denominations and organizations to disassociate with the Send. It's dangerous. And during the 2 years, we didn't lose one partnership. We didn't lose one denomination. We didn't lose one organization. And in fact, it caused a national conversation around what is the gospel. And in fact, I heard someone articulate it this way, that they said to themselves, if we haven't had this kind of negative press from the media, then what have we been doing wrong? Because we should be getting the same criticism if we're promoting the gospel of the Bible. And it created this whole conversation around what is the gospel message and what does it really mean to follow Jesus? Because there's such an attempt of the enemy, and you feel it, we feel it in America now even, not necessarily to get us to renounce our faith. Like, I don't know that that's really the attempt of the enemy. And I don't know that, you know, any of you woke up this morning and had the thought that, Buddhism would be really fun. You were just like, I just really would love an idol right now. I don't know if that was the temptation. I don't know if any of you thought Shiva, let's give Shiva a try, you know? I don't think that was the temptation. When the enemy knows that we essentially have kind of firmed ourselves in our faith, like we're gonna be followers of Jesus, I think he changes his tactic and he goes, that's fine if you follow Jesus, but I can still win if you're a safe follower of Jesus. I can still win if I can get you just to simmer down and go with the status quo. And there's such an attempt of the enemy and such an attempt of secular humanism to not just get us to renounce Christianity, but to be quiet Christians, to be safe Christians, and to be Christians who don't promote their beliefs as actual truth. And that pressure coming against the church in Norway actually backfired, and all of these movements and organizations began to take an even greater stand to go, revival or bust is basically where we're at. And so we went on this road. It was absolutely incredible. We got there a week early and did this 5 days of outreach across the city. And one of the great keys to the Send Norway and to the Send in general are this incredible group of people called Brazilians. And we had, in Norway, we had over 200 Brazilians come from Brazil for the Send Brazil. Our entire Fire and Fragrance YWAM DTS that runs out there, the whole school came to Europe. So 200 plus, 220, 230 on fire Brazilians. For 5 days together with those that came from Norway, Scandinavia, Europe, there was about 800 of us doing evangelism all across the streets of Oslo and then gathering every night for kind of blowout worship nights, much like tonight. And they said it had been over 20 years since there'd been that much evangelism in the streets of Oslo. 20 years since you could walk down the streets and bump into someone who was going to share the gospel with you. 20 years. Can you imagine a generation has grown up and not heard the public proclamation of Jesus on the streets of their city? And then all of a sudden, 800 people are flooding their city, sharing the gospel everywhere they go. And the testimonies were astounding. One of the young Brazilian teams, everyone broke up in teams. They found me in one of the evening sessions. They go, Andy, we got to share this story with you. They said, we got out of a bus on our way to our area of the city. And right away, there was a group of five people. And we could tell from the way they were dressed that they were Muslims. And one of them had a cane or was limping. Or I don't remember how they could tell that they had some kind of handicap. And so they prayed for that man, and he was instantly healed. And the rest of them were awestruck at the supernatural power of God, and all five of them gave their lives to Jesus on the spot. And there were so many stories like this, truly unprecedented. At night, those crowds began to swell. The capacity of our room we were in was 820, and that was with no chairs. Standing room only, 820 people. And the first couple nights, they were turning people away because of the hunger of the Norwegians to encounter God. And there was just power breaking out. I mean, it was raw power of God breaking out. The final night, I wasn't there because we had some other meetings. I was told that they threw out the turning people back and they got 1,100 people in the room that holds 820 people. And again, they're just saying to us, this is unprecedented. In the lead ups, they did tours all across Norway for about 9 months. To every little town and area of the nation, and they gathered 20,000 young Norwegians in their pre-rallies, seeing hundreds of salvations, commissioning thousands of young Norwegians to go to the nations to find their evangelistic voice, to stand up and find the place of faith. And that all led up to the actual gathering itself, the Send, on the Saturday. And we didn't really know how many would come. We were encouraged by the registrations, but it had been the last time there had been a big gathering of believers in the nation was 21 years ago, and it was around 10,000 people. Before that, bigger than that, was the largest gathering was 45 years ago, and it was somewhere around 20,000 people, and that was Billy Graham. And so they knew that if we were even anywhere right around 10,000, literally would have been the biggest gathering in over 20 years. And that's right where we landed, 10,500, 10,000 right in there. And so you got a whole generation of young Norwegians that never in their life have worshiped with thousands of young people. Never. They have never in their life experienced what happens when thousands of believers gather together, worship, pray, and contend for a move of God. And it was absolutely wild watching the faith through the day grow in these young Norwegians to believe that God actually was going to move in their nation again, even though they feel that they are steeped in so much secular humanism that it's impossible. And I was stunned. I remember the end of the night, we were so amazed. God moved in power. There were so many remarkable moments. And I ran into some people. We were so excited. Everybody, like hundreds of us, rolled down to the beach and just went swimming in the ocean because it's the land of the midnight sun. So it was like, you know, 11 p.m. It was totally bright out. And we just went swimming in the ocean. And I asked a young Norwegian, I was like, man, what was this like for you? And he said to me, I have never in my life been so proud to be a Norwegian. I cannot believe all these people came to believe for a breakthrough in our nation. I've never in my life experienced worshiping with this many people. And it was so many responses like that, so many testimonies even since then of the empowerment of the everyday on fire believer to believe that there's a solution of the crisis in their nation. Now for me, it was full circle moment. My first trip to Norway was 14 years ago. And I had gone for a couple days speaking in a few places. And I had heard and read of a man in Norway historically who really was the catalyst to their original spiritual awakening named Hans Nielsen Hauge. And Hans Nielsen was 25 years old, 1796. This is a long time ago. He's a farmer, poor farmer, but he's a believer. And he is plowing his field one day when he has a life-changing encounter with the love of God. Life-changing. He's already a believer, but this is different. You know what I mean. When you go from, yeah, I believe in Jesus, to like, oh my gosh, Jesus is real. And it's so profound for him. He's plowing his field that he goes into his house, and just like Saul, when he had his transformation, it says he lays in his bed for 3 days. Hans Nielsen Hauge laid in his bed for 3 days pondering this encounter he just had and how profound and impactful it was. And he lays there for 3 days undone by the love of God and weighing the implications of his obedience, knowing that in his day in Norway, it was illegal to preach the gospel outside of a church. And it was illegal to preach the gospel if you weren't a priest. So he knew that if he said yes to this encounter because he felt God had said that he was to go across the entire nation preaching the gospel to every town, every village, every little farm that he could go to, and that he was to believe and contend for a spiritual awakening in his nation, he knew it would cost him everything. And so he laid in his bed for 3 days. He gets up after those 3 days, says yes to God, and spends the rest of his life by foot traveling north to south, east to west. He gets imprisoned for 10 years of his life for preaching the gospel by the church. They throw him in prison for 10 years, in and out for a year at a time, 2 years at a time. Every time he gets out, he keeps doing what he had done. He writes hundreds and hundreds of books and pamphlets teaching about the gospel. He would walk, you know, dozens of miles for one farm in the remote parts of Norway, work all day in the farm with them, and that night gather with the family and preach the gospel and see thousands of people saved. He literally awakened the nation. Not only was he a revivalist, he was a reformer. During that time, Norway was the poorest nation in Europe. In fact, you read about how malnourished they were, and there were times when food was so short that they would add tree bark to their bread dough to make bread go further. They were so poor. Hans Nielsen Hauge had downloads from God on starting businesses across the nation. So not only would he preach the gospel and see salvation and awakening, but then he would help start businesses. And because of it, Norway, by the time he had died, was shaking with spiritual awakening. Hundreds of thousands impacted by the gospel through him and those that followed him. Not only that, but they began to prosper. Today, Norway is the richest nation in the world. per capita, the most wealthy nation in the world. And today, they have sent out more missionaries per capita than any nation in the world. One of the greatest mission-sending nations in the world, one of the greatest economically prosperous nations in the world. And all of it you can trace back to Hans Nielsen Hauge. This radical love encounter that compelled him and motivated him to a life of going for the rest of his life. In fact, every Christmas, I read this story to my kids. It's tradition. We've done it for 15 years, probably. And it's the story of one Christmas that Hans Nielsen Hauge spent in prison when his followers, they came, they actually walked several hundred miles to find him, only to find him in a prison cell and not be allowed to go and even have a word with him. And the story goes, they could see his prison cell 2-3 stories up in the building. It's Christmas day. It's night, Christmas night. They're standing in the snow looking up, and their tears are streaming down their face at the sacrifice of this man alone in his prison cell. And they're longing to just encourage him and be with him. And also they're kind of fear over the future of the movement and the awakening they're all believing for. And as they're looking, total darkness, it's at night, they see one solitary candle go up in the window of the prison cell. And it was Hans Nielsen Hauge's way of declaring that nothing will stop the light of the world. No amount of darkness, no amount of imprisonment. I might be imprisoned today, but this light will touch the whole nation. And friends, it has. 14 years ago, I went to that field that he was in where he had that life-changing encounter. I went into his home, and his bed is still there. They've turned it into a library, the bed that he would have had at the same time. And I got down on my knees on that floor, and you guys have done this, and you will do this at times in your life. And I just began to cry out, God, raise up another generation of Europeans like Hans Nielsen Hauge. God, raise up another generation of Norwegians like Hans Nielsen Hauge, who will contend for the future of this great continent, who will not stop until spiritual awakening hits the dry places of Europe. And I never dreamt that 14 years later, I would get to stand with 10,000 others from across the continent of Europe who have fire in their hearts and believe with everything in them that Europe isn't post-Christian, it's just pre-revival. It's just pre-revival. It's not over for Europe, it's just the beginning. And I walked away with that with such a sense of faith in my heart for the hour that we live in and for the incredible opportunity that's in front of us in the midst of the chaos and the darkness and the difficulty. The light of the world cannot be stopped. No amount of darkness has ever overcome light. You've never walked into a dark room, flipped on a light switch, and watched to see whether the light bulb would win out over the dark room. Light does not know how to lose. Light doesn't know how to not be light. It just needs shown. It just needs released. It just needs to put up on a candlestick. It just needs to be shown to the world around us. And I think that's very much the hour that we're in right now. As I was walking away from Norway, I'd spent some time in Portugal there too. I was amazed by the hunger of the Portuguese and just the spirit of revival that they were carrying as well. I walked away and went, isn't it? And this, and I began to process what I was experiencing and then kind of relating it to where we are in America right now. And this is what I felt like I saw. America, or so you could say Europe in some ways, in its bent towards secular humanism, might be 20 years ahead of America historically. And then 20 years later, America kind of follows some of those trends. Now, America is so rapidly moving right now in that direction that we're no longer 20 years behind. We're soon, you know, leading the charge. But historically, we've been 20 years behind. So most of these young Norwegians that were gathered, and many of the Europeans, majority were from mainland Europe and Norway, and then our Brazilians who brought the fire. Most of them have grown up in school being made fun of for being Christians. Most of them. Most of them didn't know a single other believer in their class. Most of them were too afraid to read their Bibles publicly because they knew they'd get ridiculed for it. So the believers that have emerged out of this pressure of cultural humanism are actually carrying the authentic seed of the gospel because they've overcome. They overcame the pressure. They didn't give in. They didn't relent. And so those 10,000 that gathered, they weren't just 10,000. They were 10,000 overcomers, not living in the gray space of Christianity, not living in kind of a quasi-Christian life, not kind of half in, half out, 1 foot in, 1 foot out. These were young people who had already paid a price at 17 years old, already paid a price at 18 years old. And because of it, because of the pressure around them, it's actually producing the authentic seed of the gospel again. And friends, there's no hope for spiritual awakening, no matter how big the church is, if it doesn't have the authentic seed of the gospel in it. It doesn't matter how big the mega church is. It doesn't matter how big the population of Christianity is. If we're living in the gray space, there's no power. Oh, it is. I would much rather have 100 authentic believers than 100,000 who are living in compromise and calling themselves Christians. And what I experienced in Norway was the authentic seed. It was like the enemy's like, Europe's done, post-Christian, all of this. But he didn't realize that by putting pressure on the believers, the church became the church. By putting pressure on believers, authenticity rose up again in the heart of the believers. They overcame the mockery. They overcame the criticism, the obstacles. And that's the most dangerous force on the earth. One believer who has taken a stand on truth with love, standing in the face of all of that opposition is the power of transformation. And I walked away from that time in Europe going, oh my gosh, what's about to happen in America? What's about to happen in America? What are we on the verge of if this kind of pressure is coming on Gen Z like no generation in history? Never has there been a greater ideological battle over the mind of a generation than Gen Z. And to those who overcome, look out. To those who overcome, look out. Because the authentic transformational seed of the gospel is in the generation that overcomes the mounting pressure. And it won't be the masses that lead to spiritual awakening. It will be the power and the authenticity of the real gospel in our lives that begins spiritual awakening. And I walked away so excited for where we're at, even as a nation in America, even as crazy as it is. I'm like, oh, look out. The church is gonna rise glorious and beautiful, and the gray space is gonna be gone, and maybe we'll have fewer millions than we had, but those that we do have will be walking in authentic, sold out, wholehearted, surrendered Christianity. And that's the faith that has the power to bring transformation. So tonight I was asking the Lord, I'm just kind of praying for you guys, never have shared this message as a commissioning message, but thinking about what could I share in light of all of this to kind of commission you guys, those that are in the school, as you head back to your home states, home cities, hometowns, universities, those that are part of the live in Orange County and you're part of this Monday night community and family, as you're commissioned to live this in Orange County in California, a place that we all know needs massive breakthrough. As the Circuit Rider staff head out across the nation, we're kind of all getting commissioned. And what could I share in regards to that? And this is what I thought. When pressure begins to mount around us and the culture begins to be anti many of the things that we believe, and even sometimes maliciously, sometimes passively, much like what Hans Nielsen Hauge faced in his time and in his day, the culture around him told him that everything he was doing was not allowed. You need to be an ordained priest to preach the gospel. You need to be in a church building. You're just a farmer. What do you know? This is not legal. This is not possible. And we're throwing you in prison. If we live in a response to culture, we will never sustain our commissioning long term. But if we live in response to our love encounter, we will live it for the rest of our lives. If our rising up is simply a response to our pressure, and a response to secular humanism, will actually rise up with an edge of cynicism. We'll actually rise up with an edge of offense. We'll actually get zeal and get passion, but sort of like we're gonna stick it to the man, or we're gonna overcome what's around us, or we're gonna show them what's real, or wait till real power breaks out. And all of those things can be short-term motivators. They can commission us for the short term. But the danger of that motivation is eventually we get decommissioned by the state of our own heart. If we're only evangelizing as missionaries, preaching, praying because of the culture around us, it's the wrong motivation. And it'll never last. And when tragedy hits and offense hits or rejection hits or disappointment hits, we'll be decommissioned instead of commissioned for the rest of our lives. The reason Hans Nielsen Hauge was able to sustain what happened in his life and all the offense of the church imprisoning him. These are your own people. The church is the one throwing him in prison, is that he was sustained because he wasn't commissioned as a response to his frustration to culture. He was commissioned by a love encounter with God in a field as a farmer. And the only thing that will sustain what we're believing for is not as a response to culture, but as a response to the extravagant love of God. And that's the love that led the saints of old, led our heroes in history to lay their very lives down for the sake of the gospel and always stay tender to the broken culture around them. It's thick skin and a tender heart. They didn't allow the pressure around them to get jaded towards the culture, because how can you reach a culture you're jaded towards? Their entire radical obedience was summed up in one giant response to the revelation of the love of God. It's the only motivator that will sustain us. It's the only motivator. In some ways, I think one of the most important verses in the entire Bible when it comes to sustaining the calling and the commissioning on our lives is John chapter 15. I think this verse holds the key to sustainability, to the zeal and the passion we've experienced tonight, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 40 years from now. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. This verse, as the Father has loved me, can you imagine the intensity of the love of the Father towards the Son? Oh, to get in the middle of that love must be dangerous. The love of the Father towards the Son. And he says, as the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. And then his command to us, the greatest command in all of Scripture, right? As if God is like some kind of harsh God. His great command is stay in my love. His great command is remain here and you'll bear much fruit. Remain in my love. And just so you know, my love is as intense for you as the Father's love is for me. That's the intensity, the passion, the extravagance of my love for you is the same that the Father has for me. Now remain in my love. Friends, the only way we will see true transformation in America and in the nations and among the unreached, in all the harder and more difficult places, is a people who have learned to remain in the love of God. Not reactionary to culture, not reactionary to our times, aware, educated, wise, but reacting to the love of God day and night. Reacting to the reality that I wake up in the morning and life might be hard, but he loves me. Life might be difficult, but his extravagant love is so intense towards me. And my interest tonight is not just that we would have one great night of commissioning. My interest tonight is you would never be decommissioned in your life. That's my interest. That when tragedy hits, you know what to do. You run to the love of God. When difficulty hits, you know what to do. Not throw in the towel, not blame someone, not get offended. Run to the love of God. When rejection hits, you don't give in to the lie, the bait of Satan to be offended at that person. You run to the love of God. And if you, for the rest of your life, young circuit riders, for the rest of your life, if you would run to the extravagant, ridiculous, audacious, intense love of God, you will never be decommissioned no matter what happens around you. Your circumstances won't dictate your future or your calling. His love will drive you forward again and again and again. I want to illustrate this briefly tonight, and we'll jump back into worship. In the life of the disciples walking with Jesus, and I just love to think about this was real life. These weren't just stories. You really got to like kind of imagine, allow your imagination to enter into the story to feel what really would have happened. And the disciples, you know, they're awesome because they just qualify all of us. You just read about them and you're like, man, I'm in. If they're in, I'm in. And they're human. And it's just so helpful to have human examples, right? Christianity is not about being superhuman. It's about being human with a supernatural power of the Holy Spirit. And the disciples, they embody that. And, you know, the disciples in Jesus's life, they were his best friends. They were his best friends on the earth. I mean, he's got Mary and he's got his disciples, his mom and his disciples. They're his closest friends. And for 3.5 years with his guys, with his 12 dudes, I mean, they become deep friends. And of course, he's got these amazing women around him as well that he has deep friendship with. The disciples are the 12, but there's a bigger group around him. And these are his best friends. And you think about all that they went through in their lives together. I mean, raising the dead, walking on water, you know, casting out demons. And you think about how fast and deep friendship would go in that intense environment. Like some of you guys have only known each other for 8 days, right, since coming here. But because of the intensity of the environment, you feel like you know each other a little bit more. Imagine 3.5 years and it's Jesus and you're raising the dead and you're multiplying fish and food. You know what I mean? The miracles are driving your friendship to a place that doesn't happen in normal life. The power, all of it, the camaraderie. I mean, Jesus is out in the open fields with them. Every night they're out sleeping, you know, in the fields or in homes together. They're eating meals together. This is real friendship. This wasn't distant rabbi and, you know, lame disciples. Like, this is deep camaraderie. They're doing all of life together. They know each other intimately, deeply. They're making fun of each other. They had to be laughing so hard. Jesus was the perfect man, which means he was the funniest person to ever live. He had the purest humor. He had the purest joy. His jokes were the best jokes ever told in human history. Can you imagine? The Holy Spirit is the inspiration to every joke you tell. That's Jesus. But you got to feel the fun and the camaraderie. This isn't just like business and classroom and I'm your rabbi and I'll be your teacher. That's not how he did it. It's real life. It's day in and it's day out. We know Peter, James, and John, they're like his inner core. They're his three that he brings into like even more in-depth moments. They experience more than any of the other disciples. They're brought into another level of friendship. And when you really think about that, then I want you to walk into Jesus's passion, where Jesus is actually about to experience, you know, the hardest trial of his life on earth. And you know the story, they have the Last Supper together. They have a great meal. Judas is on the way to betray him. They head out into the garden, and it's there that Judas leads this, you know, army basically to find Jesus. And if there was ever a moment in Jesus's entire life that he actually really needed friends, it was the next 24 hours. There was ever a time where it was like, I mean, he's a son of God. He's got really good friendship with God. He's human though, so of course he's enjoying human interaction. He's fully human, and he's loving these friendships. But if there was ever a time he needed these friendships, like just needed someone to stand with him, it was the next 24 hours. And then I want you to imagine this kind of friendship, this kind of camaraderie, probably deeper than almost any friendship in the room. There'd be some of you that have walked together for 10 years and you have gone through trials together and you've overcome and you have that level of friendship. But I'm telling you, the disciples and Jesus' friendship was deeper than maybe most of us have really ever experienced. And then in that moment, all of a sudden, Jesus being betrayed, Judas betrays him with a kiss, they capture him, and in that moment, every one of your friends runs off. Every one of them. Imagine this moment. I don't know if we've ever really taken time to think about it. And Jesus is alone. He's absolutely alone. If there was a moment he needed friends, one of them led to his betrayal, and we always think Judas, man, awful Judas. Guys, the other 11 ditched him. They just ran off. They're afraid for their own lives. They don't know what's going to happen to them. They run off, right? And then to make matters worse, Jesus is, you know, going through these various kind of trial moments, and Peter won't even admit he knows Jesus. And Peter's like one of the three, the deepest of the deepest. He's like friendship of all friendship. And Jesus is aware of this. He prophesied it, and he sees him in his final denial moment. Can you imagine this? And moments later, Peter pulled out a sword and cut a dude's ear off, ready to defend Jesus. Moments later, he's running for his life and he won't even admit he knows Jesus. And can you imagine, because Jesus, you remember, he's fully human. The emotion of abandonment in that moment from his friends, all alone. We know he goes all the way to the cross and John is the only disciple, his mom. The only disciple standing there with him is John, the only one. The other 11, gone. Where's Peter? Gone. Wouldn't even admit he knew Jesus. This, to me, is like the ultimate betrayal you could imagine. Your closest of friends. And then I want you to imagine this level, you know, Jesus dies. How are they even wrestling with the emotions in their heart? Not only his loss, but their abandonment of him in his loss. For 3 days, there, I would imagine the depression was intense. The discouragement, the condemnation, the shame. Peter, most of all, who was so flamboyant, so passionate about Jesus and protecting him, now wouldn't even admit he knew him. Just think about this for a moment. And then I want you to imagine Jesus rises from the dead. And I want you to think for one moment, what in the world do you do when you see him face to face for the first time? Have you ever thought about that? If you're Peter, how do you like even strike up a conversation? You're like, hey, remember that thing? Like, we good? Sorry? This is real. These are real moments. So interesting to me that when Jesus rises from the dead, and then he appears to his disciples 3 times, at least in the book of John, in different accounts, different records, that on the third time that he appears to them, this is what really struck me when I read this. Here's what I want to propose to you. That though Jesus had risen from the dead, that the mission of salvation and the forgiveness of sins was successful. But the mission of the messengers of salvation and freedom from sin was not yet successful. I don't think these guys know what to do. They abandoned their best friend in his only moment of need. And now he's back and they're like, what do we do now? Like, we failed. We utterly and completely failed. So then in John chapter 21, put all of those emotions in context to this story. After this, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. This is the conversation. And in this context, this conversation makes a lot more sense. Simon Peter, Thomas, Nathaniel, the sons of Zebedee. So this is the guys, Peter, James, John, all of them, bunch of them. Two other disciples were together. So a bunch of them are together. And this is what Peter says. And you got to realize the implications behind this statement. I'm going out to fish. He says, I'm going out to fish. Simon Peter told them and they said, we'll go with you. So they went out, got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Now, 3.5 years earlier, Jesus had found Peter on a boat. He had told him, put down your net on the other side. He's like, or he says, go back out to the deep and throw out your net. And they're like, we fished all night. He goes, just do it. Throw down the net. The catch is bigger than they can contain. Peter falls on his knees and says, basically, leave me. I'm an unclean man. Like, I have issues. Like, who are you? I've never seen anything like this. And Jesus looks at him and says, follow me. From now on, you're a fisher of men. From now on, I'm commissioning you. And he commissioned him to be a fisher of men. 3.5 years later, Peter has been decommissioned by his own decisions and his own choices. 3.5 years later, Peter's gone back to the very thing that Jesus called him to. Could there have been any greater slap in the face of the risen Messiah than that the disciples would go back to the very thing he had called them from and commissioned them into? And Peter, I propose to you, was so overcome with shame, so overcome with condemnation, so overcome with his own guilt that he didn't know what to do other than to go back to his old way of life. And as if, you know, we're always hard on Peter, but guys, the rest of them went with him. They're like, yeah, we don't know what else to do either. Let's go fishing. So they all go out fishing. Now Jesus, it says, early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore. Now, thank God that we're not Jesus. Because in this moment, if I'm Jesus, I'm like, hey, I loved you guys really well for 3.5 years. I died on a stinking cross for you guys. And you're fishing? He goes, well, if love didn't work, then maybe fear will. And like, bring out a storm, resurrect Leviathan from the deep. Like, bring a dinosaur back. This is the moment. Pterodactyls. Like, terrorize them into obedience, right? What do you do? If you're Jesus, this moment, you go, for crying out loud, I've done everything for you guys. And you've gone back to the very thing I called you from. What do you do if you're Jesus in this moment? Well, praise God, we're not Jesus. At least that I'm not Jesus. He yells out to them. I love this. He's kind of making fun of them because he knows they've failed in their compromise. He goes, friends, have you any fish? Of course he knows they have no fish. Just wanted to hear him say it. How's it going out there compromising in the lake? They go, no. He says the most ridiculous thing. It's totally ridiculous. I grew up, I worked on commercial fishing boats. I'm from Alaska. And he says, now, if you've ever seen even pictures of the boats these guys worked on, they're not very big, right? They're the width of, like, you know, maybe a little bit more than one length of this stage. And he says, throw your net on the other side. Makes no sense. Like, we fished all night and didn't catch fish right here. He's like, yeah, but throw it 5 feet over and fish right there. And you're going to catch a ton of fish. If you're a fisherman, you're like, what is wrong with this guy? And he says, throw your fish on your nets on the other side, and you will find some. When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish, the exact scenario of the first time he called them. Exact scenario. Come on, guys, this is so key. If you get this tonight, nothing can decommission you. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, which you got, John's writing this, and John is the disciple whom Peter loved. He refers to himself as the one who Jesus loved. I don't know whether he was prideful or insecure or super confident. I don't know what it was. But he says, the disciple whom Jesus loved, which is John who wrote this, said to Peter, which John and Peter got a little rivalry going on. It's clear throughout lots of scripture. He goes, just so that everybody knows for all of history that John is the one who said to Peter, it is the Lord. It's God, it's Jesus. You didn't get it, but it is Jesus. And he writes it down so everyone would know that John knew it was Jesus before Peter did. And listen, then he makes fun of Peter. He goes, as soon as Simon Peter heard him say, so he's totally mocking him here. He says, as soon as he hears him say, it is the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off, and he jumped into the water. Then verse 8, the other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from the shore. He's sort of like, I don't know why Peter jumped in. We were pretty close to the shore, so we just rowed the boat in. But Peter jumped in, and we still beat him there. About 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. Who is this Messiah? Who is this Jesus? Total, absolute failure. Unbelievable abandonment in the moment you actually needed your friends. Wouldn't even admit they knew him. Then on top of it all, he's risen from the dead and they're fishing. And Jesus goes, man, this is the perfect opportunity. I have a strategy. I need these guys to take the message of the gospel all over the world. And they're going to pay a high price for it. I have an idea. Breakfast. Yeah. Some of you are like, man, that is a God idea. I'm hungry right now. Breakfast. Now get this. They come to shore. He's been cooking. He's got a fish ready, bread ready for them. And that's his strategy. Bring some fish that you caught. Simon goes back in the boat, gets a fish. They caught 153, so much so that the net was torn. And he says to them, come and have breakfast. Now, here's what I want to conclude with. For 3.5 years, Jesus radically loved the disciples. There's no question of that. It wasn't like he withheld love. I guarantee you, he made most breakfasts for 3.5 years. Those guys were sleeping in. They were tired. Jesus was up early, and he was cooking breakfast. Right? This wasn't the first breakfast he made for them. Jesus loved them extravagantly. He couldn't love them anymore. He's Jesus. He loved them perfectly for 3.5 years. And they totally abandoned him. Totally failed him. Personally, totally walked away from him in his greatest moment of need. Then he catches them in their compromise, cooks breakfast for them one more time, and every one of them, except for John, goes on to die a martyr's death for the gospel. 3.5 years, perfect love leading to abandonment. Breakfast on the beach, and they all go on to die for the gospel. And we sit in these chairs today because they obeyed the Great Commission. We sit in these chairs. 3.5 years of radical, extravagant, perfect love, and they decommission themselves by their choices in the state of their own hearts. Breakfast on the beach, and they're never decommissioned again for the rest of their lives. And I just want to propose to you that for 3.5 years, the disciples were mostly responding to the culture around them. For 3.5 years, the disciples were mostly vying for their position in the kingdom. So much so they were getting their moms involved. Doesn't get lower than that. For 3.5 years, they want to call down fire on people that don't agree with them. For 3.5 years, they're buddy-buddy with Jesus. They're fighting for who's closest to him. They're fighting for who's the greatest disciple. They're arguing about it. Their motivation was off. 3.5 years later, their motivation gets exposed when they abandon him in his greatest moment of need when the threat comes at their own lives. And they get decommissioned by the state of their motivation in their heart. They enter back into the very lifestyle he called them from. He cooks one breakfast for them on the beach, doing what he probably had done many times, but for the first time in maybe their lives, they had a true love encounter. Because maybe for the first time in 3.5 years, they realized they didn't deserve his love. And for 3.5 years, they were arguing about who he loved the most. And now they taste failure, they taste obstacles, they taste difficulty, they taste pressure and persecution. They walk away from him, one breakfast on the beach, and all of a sudden they go, my gosh, when I least deserved it. When I didn't deserve any mercy. When I didn't deserve to be a disciple any longer. When my own decisions had disqualified me. He comes back in with the same love. And they have their Hans Nielsen Hauge encounter. And because of it, every one of them goes on to lay their whole lives down for the sake of the gospel, never to be decommissioned by the state of their heart or their motivation again. Love is the motivator. And just a few pages over, I just think it's just divine kindness that John and Acts, even though Luke wrote Luke and Acts, they put John in the middle, and that we go from John telling about Peter's failure to Peter's restoration through breakfast on the beach to Acts chapter 2, when if there was any disciple who shouldn't have stood up and preached at Pentecost, it was Peter. We're talking weeks away from when he denied knowing Jesus. He stands up and preaches the first message of the church in history. And I have to think the moment we read these words, we read right over them. Verse 14, then Peter stood up. History was made that moment. And maybe for the first time in Peter's life, he stood up motivated by love. Instead of motivated by ambition, instead of motivated by frustration, instead of being motivated by a response to culture, instead of being motivated by desire for status or desire for position or desire for a title or notoriety or influence or fame. And maybe for the first time in his life, he stands up motivated by love. And he preaches a message and thousands are saved and the church is birthed and we're here today because of that. And I want to say as we look to the future, as we look towards commissioning, it's as important that we would consider ourselves commissioned, that we would also consider ourselves to never be decommissioned, and that we would so protect this thing with the love of God, that we would so protect ourselves against offense, because I'm telling you, it's just gonna come. It's just gonna come. Like tragedy's gonna hit. We're going to lose friends along the way. We're going to lose loved ones along the way. It's gonna happen. The question isn't how do we safeguard ourselves against tragedy? The question is how do we walk through it with a tender heart and not allow tragedy to decommission us because we begin to question the goodness of God. You've gotta settle in your heart right now. He's good and he doesn't know how to be anything else. And your circumstances are never the indication of his goodness. His goodness transcends your circumstances. His goodness, he never promised it would be easy. He just promised he'd never leave us when it was hard. He never promised that people would love us. In fact, he promised they wouldn't love us. And the only way we'll sustain it, because these things will come, difficulty, tragedy. Like right now, we're in such an environment of faith. And man, as much as we can, we live out of these environments. And we get commissioned out of these environments. But many of you are going back to environments that aren't this full of faith. And it can be easy to get frustrated with the church. Guess what? You've just been decommissioned. It can be easy to get jaded towards other believers. You've just been decommissioned. It can be easy to blame God for difficulty in your life. You've just been decommissioned. It can be easy to question his goodness. How can a good God fill in the blank? We've just decommissioned ourselves. It can be easy when we receive persecution from the church itself that doesn't understand, misunderstands, judges our motives, and they were wrong in it. But if we allow offense to stay in our hearts, we've decommissioned ourselves. We're gonna have struggles. You're gonna have areas where you feel like you fail. You're gonna have standards that you really go after and holiness. And at times you're gonna feel like you failed in those standards. What are you gonna do? Disqualify yourself or run back to the extravagant love of God? It's only his love that can motivate us for the long term. Why don't you stand and maybe the worship team can jump up. And this is the last passage because I can't go there without ending here. In the saga of Peter's life, this gets me. Oh, this is my life verse. I gave it away right there. Peter writes near the end of his life. We've gone through a bit of Peter's life from life as a disciple to his betrayal moment with Jesus, to his restoration, to his rising up in the book of Acts. But this is how it ends for Peter, and this is the commissioning I want to pray over each one of us tonight. Is he writes in 1 Peter to the persecuted church. Specifically, he's writing to a persecuted believers. They're going through difficulty, suffering, pain, and persecution. They believe that most likely these churches were started by Paul, and now Paul is dead, and Peter is writing to encourage them. They're not only persecuted, but they've lost their beloved leader. And Peter writes, it's not for sure that all of that is the case, but certainly it's sure that they are persecuted believers because he's writing about it throughout. And he's writing to them, and he gets to this incredible moment. I'm going to start in verse 6. Just listen. You don't even have to read it. In all this, you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. These have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. Listen to this. I have to think Peter sat back, thought deeply about his own journey, and then wrote this sentence. Though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him. And you are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy, for you have received the end result of your faith, the salvation of your souls. And I have to think Peter sat back and went, I walked with him for 3.5 years. I was one of his best friends. I can still hear the sound of his voice in my ear. I can still smell his aroma when he was near. I can tell you what his laugh was like. I can mimic his walk. I can show you his mannerisms. I knew him that much. I knew him that closely. And when trial hit, I abandoned him. And he looks at this persecuted church the way that he would look at Gen Z going, you're gonna face pressures. And I think he sits back with awe and he goes, you've never even seen him and yet you love him. I saw him, knew him, and walked with him and abandoned him. He goes, you have never even seen him and you love him. You still don't see him even now, and yet in your persecution, you refuse to back down and you believe in him. And then this sentence is what I want to commission you in. And you have been filled with a glorious and inexpressible joy. Because you are receiving the end result of your faith, even now you have ripped eternity into the moment. And even now you have gained eternal life through your faith in an unseen Christ. And I read this sentence once and it became for me a life prayer. That this glorious and inexpressible joy, it was like the joy of heaven before heaven through fellowship with the unseen Christ. Think about that sentence for a moment. The joy of heaven before heaven through fellowship with the unseen Christ. Peter had fellowship with him and didn't love him the way that these disciples did. This is Gen Z. You haven't seen him like Peter, but you can love him more than Peter did. You never have to be decommissioned. You never have to. You still may not see him now, and yet you can have a faith unshakable to all the pressure of the world around you. and we don't get commissioned tonight out of a sense of drudgery or coming suffering or coming pain. We get commissioned tonight out of an inexpressible and glorious joy because we are receiving the end result of our faith, which is eternal life now. It's the fellowship we will have with him in heaven right now through our faith and our love for someone we still have never even seen with our eyes. And that's what I want to commission us in tonight, is that the sustainer of your life in God for the 20, 30, 50, 60 years ahead would be the glorious and inexpressible joy of the love of God over your life. That you would wake up in trial and your first sentence would be, "He loves me." You would wake up and go, "I blew it yesterday," and your first sentence would be, "He loves me and there is forgiveness for me." You would wake up in tragedy and pain and allow yourself to feel the real pain and the real tragedy and the real mourning, but you would look yourself in the mirror and go, "But his love is enough to sustain me even in this." When you face pressure from culture around, that you wouldn't grow aggravated and respond to culture, but you would grow tender and respond to his love. And friends, if we walk this out, nothing can stop us. The enemy can't stop us. And the story of our lives will be that we laid our entire lives down for the sake of the gospel. And we lived our 70, 80, 90 years, never being decommissioned by the state of our motives or the state of our heart, but all the years of our lives motivated by the radical and glorious love of Jesus. So Holy Spirit, I wanna pray over these circuit riders, these fiery ones, Lord, these burning ones. And I just ask for a commissioning joy to hit us tonight. God, I'm asking for that inexpressible, beyond words, beyond vocabulary, and glorious joy to hit our hearts tonight. And Father, I'm asking wherever you need to encounter us with fresh love, those that have experienced recent failure, God, I pray that you would show yourself as the breakfast cooking Jesus over their failure right now, God. Those that have experienced recent rejection, show yourself as the breakfast cooking Jesus over their rejection, God. Those who have experienced pressure from friends and family to conform, God, fill them with a glorious and inexpressible joy tonight. Father, I'm asking for love encounters like Hans Nielsen Hauge had. God, mess us up with your love tonight. Reorient our hearts tonight, that everything would flow from the revelation of your love for us, God. Everything would flow from that love encounter, God. Whatever has happened in our past, that we would never allow it to decommission us from our future, God. And I pray tonight, whoever needs to hear that, that Jesus cooks breakfast in the midst of our past shame and our past condemnation, Lord, that we would be healed tonight and restored tonight, like Peter, to stand up and proclaim the goodness and the love of God. Father, I pray that over everyone tonight. Let your love be poured out. Just begin to respond to his love. Sing about it, declare it. Sing in the Spirit, pray in the Spirit. Let's just ask for a love encounter tonight. He's so good. He's so loving. He's so kind.
Thank you for listening to the Circuit Rider Podcast. For our full library of podcasts and more information about the Circuit Riders, visit us at crmovement.com. To get involved with the day-to-day of what we do or to see what's happening across the nation, follow us at CR Movement on Instagram. We'll see you on the road.